This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day, powered by 2,600 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter on this edition of Bloomberg Best for Monday, May 15th.
Congressman Kevin Brady, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, talks about tax reform.
Tax reform, as you know, is the challenge of a generation for any Congress. We do have a lot of work to do, but I'm confident we can finish it this year.
And we speak with Italian Finance Minister Pier Carlo Padoan following the G7 meetings.
Protection is off the table. I think that there was no disagreement on the fact that trade promotes growth and has to be inclusive.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
The days and weeks after the election were a dark time for the Democratic Party. But just 6 months after Hillary Clinton's defeat, newly elected DNC chairman Tom Perez is working to bring the Democrats back to power. He spoke with Bloomberg's Kevin Cirilli, and they began with the firing of James Comey.
I want to give you a chance to respond to something that Republicans have been saying for quite some time since the firing, which is that, hey, wait a minute. Democrats had argued that Director Comey was doing a bad job repeatedly. It's hypocritical. That's the word we hear of them to make this case. What's your response?
Oh, quite simply, I absolutely had issues, serious issues with what Director Comey did. But the fact of the matter is that had absolutely nothing to do with his firing. When we heard President Trump said, I fired him because he mistreated Hillary Clinton. I mean, that doesn't pass the laugh test. And they went off of that because they knew that was not good.
So
just to be clear, he was fired because he's the investigator in an investigation that could implicate the president of the United States. That is an affront to our democracy. That's an affront to our independence.
And that's the point that I want to pick up on, though, because as whomever President Trump nominates, and I want to ask you this again, if no Democrats support whomever that nominee is this FBI director legitimate?
Well, I want the FBI director to be able to command the respect of the American people.
Does he need Democrats to do that?
Well, having Democrats to do that would be helpful, but more importantly, what you need, Kevin, is the appointment of an independent prosecutor. Because you know what happens? If you get the best FBI director, but you are reporting up the chain to a Department of Justice that Donald Trump seems to have in his back pocket, then the best director in the world doesn't get you anywhere.
Have there been any names, Mr. Chairman, that have been made public that are on the short list for FBI director? People like Senator John Cornyn, for example, who have been on there that you could get behind?
Well, I mean, Senator John Cornyn is the perfect example of what not to do. I mean, he's a partisan Republican. He has been defending Donald Trump. And you're going to put him in charge of the FBI where they would be investigating the interaction between Trump and Putin? I mean, that is beyond the fox guarding the hen house. And that's why you need, first of all, to have an independent counsel looking at the investigation. And then you need, there are plenty of people out there. But the challenge is that what the president did last week in firing Comey, clearly motivated by the fact that he was involved in the Russia investigation, any credible FBI director worth her salt or worth his salt is going to have serious hesitation to take a job where there are loyalty oaths that appear to be demanded.
Well, let's talk about other tough jobs. You've got a tough job as chairman of the DNC. You're having to unify this Democratic Party. How is that going? What are you having to do? And what are some of your objectives
sure.
now?
Sure. Well, I think we're making progress. We still have work to do. And we have to get back to basics as a Democratic Party. When we put our values into action, and when we lead with our unity and our values, we do very well. And I'll give you an example. The healthcare efforts of this administration to repeal the Affordable Health Care Act and to put 24 million Americans in jeopardy and tens of millions of Americans with pre-existing conditions in jeopardy and seniors who rely on the Affordable Care Act for their prescription drug benefits. Our unity has been our greatest strength, and we're going to continue to fight as
But there's
Democrats.
A palpable anger, Mr. Chairman. You know this. You've been all over the country, both as chairman and as previous in your capacity as Department of Labor Secretary in the Obama administration. You know, I've interviewed activists all across the country during the campaign, and left, right, there's an anger. How do you, as you head into midterm elections, cultivate that and channel that, and which seats in particular, especially in 2018, are on your mind?
Well, let's start with 2017, because we've got gubernatorial elections in New Jersey and in Virginia. And what we have to do is, again, make sure we're leading with our values. That's why we're together on health care. When you see what the president tried to do to enact a budget that would have eliminated Meals on Wheels, that's a morally bankrupt budget. And people understand that. And that's why this energy. Well, tax reform is what his effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act is about, except what it is. It's not tax reform. It's a massive tax cut for wealthy people, because the way the Affordable Care Act subsidies were financed was a tax on wealthy people. And what the Affordable Care Act repeal is about is, first of all, an age tax on people over 50, and secondly, a massive tax cut for wealthy people.
That was DNC Chair Tom Perez speaking with Bloomberg's Kevin Cirilli.
Coming up, a breakdown of what was discussed at the G7 meeting with Italy's finance minister, Pier Carlo Padoan.
You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg. G7 finance ministers wrapped up their meeting in Italy over the weekend. Italy's finance minister, Pier Carlo Padoan, spoke with Bloomberg's Matt Miller following those talks. They began with a recent worldwide cyber attacks.
The G7 has already set in place a cyber attack working group that has been working for several months. And, of course, the mandate has been confirmed and reinforced. We had a lot of discussion about the implications for security, for cybersecurity of the digitalization of the economy. We have reiterated our commitment as G7 to be proactive and have a leadership function in dealing concretely with these threats, including by involving the private sector to develop more effective cyber defense systems.
What do you think about the use of Bitcoin in this attack? It's been an interesting phenomenon to watch the last 5 years, and it's come to an all-time high last week of more than $1,800 apiece.
Well, this is yet another example of how policymakers, both nationally and globally, have to face up to new challenges. These are the Bitcoin digital economy are there to stay, and the success you mentioned just confirms that. So this has positive aspects, but also negative, undesirable consequences that have to be dealt with. And this requires collective action. This is the main message that came out of our meeting.
Stamping out protectionism has also been a concern that requires collective action. You couldn't quite come to an agreement to include that in the communique. How important is it?
It is important. Protectionism is off the table. I think that there was no disagreement on the fact that trade promotes growth and has to be inclusive. So I am very satisfied. Of course, we need to make steps forward. There are different views across the G7 and the G20 for that. But I am confident that we can reach common views on even on these issues.
How was working with the U.S. delegation and Secretary Mnuchin on this subject and on the subject of addressing income inequality?
Very constructive, very pragmatic. Of course, we recognize that there are different starting points, different views in different countries, but this is not an obstacle to reaching a common perspective, and I'm confident as we make progress and we increase interaction, we'll make progress in practical issues as well.
Working together on tax policy is also very important to you. How was the U.S. contribution to the tax policy discussion?
Well, I'm happy to see that the U.S. delegation joins the others, both at the G7 and the G20 level, in recognizing that the tax area is the one in which there have been more progress in international collaboration. This has several aspects, one of which is related to the digital economy, but it's also fighting tax crime, improving tax transparency and exchange of information. So I'm quite confident that we make progress in all areas as we move forward.
Is it a more difficult subject when you focus in on Europe right now?
Europe is not a problem. Europe is a contributor, an important contributor to growth. And I think that this has been seen, especially when we discuss inclusive growth and the so-called Bari policy agenda, which we agreed to deliver today, which provides a framework for making growth more inclusive, of course, while respecting national diversities and case-by-case approaches.
I mean, specifically when it comes to, for example, Brexit, the concern is that the UK could lower tax rates to attract more business. What do you think about that issue?
Well, maybe this is not news, but we didn't even mention Brexit during the 2 days of discussion.
Brexit wasn't discussed at all here?
No. We discussed other items because the agenda proposed by us to the colleagues was extremely focused and concrete. Cybersecurity, taxation issues, reform of the multilateral development banks, and the global economy as an overview. But within that context, we didn't discuss Brexit in particular.
It has been reported that you did discuss the Italian banking crisis with Mr. Mnuchin in the bilateral talks on Thursday night. How do you see the bad loan situation panning out? Because I've heard that it could improve more quickly than maybe the financial markets expect.
We are already seeing encouraging signs of NPL stocks going down, stop increasing, going down to market solutions, which is good news. At the same time, as it is well known, there are some limited specific cases that we are directly dealing with because they will involve public money to be used as a precautionary support to capital. So from that point of view, yes, the situation is not finalized yet, but we're going in the right direction.
Can you give us specifics as far as numbers on NPLs, net bad debt, when it could be, or how low it could go?
Well, numbers that have been floating around since very recently amount to several hundred billion euros of NPLs. This is a gross figure. It is grossly overestimating the impact. I would say that now we are talking about tens of billions of NPLs that are slowly but surely being eliminated from banks' balance sheets.
That was Italy's finance minister, Pier Carlo Padoan, speaking with Bloomberg's Matt Miller.
And coming up, we talk cybersecurity with former Admiral James Stavridis.
You can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on the gender gap when women and men vote differently with Bloomberg's Elizabeth Titus.
The situation.
All it refers to is the difference in how men and women tend to vote. And in the U.S., since that 1980 election, women have tended to support the Democratic candidate more often and men the Republican candidate.
The background.
It goes back to the 60s and 70s when you saw more women entering the workforce. And then in 1980, Ronald Reagan opposed the Supreme Court's decision to uphold abortion rights. This became a campaign issue.
The argument.
The question is really, or there are a number of questions really, including how candidates should respond to this. Should they cater to segments of voters differently as a result? Is that a strategically smart thing to do?
For more on the gender gap or other quick takes, go to BloombergView.com/quicktake. Or for terminal customers, go to NIQuick. I'm Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter.
Governments and companies around the world have started to gain the upper hand against an unprecedented cyber attack, which authorities say has impacted more than 200,000 computers in 150 countries. Retired Admiral James Stavridis testified last week before a Senate committee on cybersecurity, and he spoke about the issue earlier today with Bloomberg's Tom Keene and David Gura.
Admiral Stavridis, great to speak with you once again. Describe what we saw here on Friday, the degree to which you were worried about this beforehand and how worried we should be that we could see something like this happen again and perhaps again and again and again.
I was very worried when I testified, and I'm even more worried now. And let's face it, David, this is going to be a rolling thunder of a series of attacks. This particular one was derived from tools that were, if you will, released into the wild from the National Security Agency. They're very potent. They can be manipulated. We should expect more of this, unfortunately.
On that note, I read the blog post by the president of Microsoft, that being one Brad Smith, and he said the government should treat this attack as a wake-up call. And he said, this attack provides yet another example of why the stockpiling of vulnerabilities by governments is such a problem. Here you have some particular expertise. Why is the government stockpiling all this? What would a company like Microsoft like to see the government do?
Well, let's think of two kind of similar looming towers. One was Pearl Harbor, and another one was 9/11. In both cases, the nation took a devastating blow, and afterwards, we convened a blue ribbon commission and looked at what we need to do.
Yeah.
This time, you can see this looming tower. Let's get that group of smart people together and tell us what we need to do to protect ourselves.
Okay, Admiral, so we had Pearl Harbor. No one saw it coming except maybe Halsey, who put a third of the fleet out to sea. Where's Admiral King? Where's the Admiral King of cybersecurity to give us the urgency to get up on the table and start screaming?
I think it reposes in the business world. So it's people like Eric Schmidt. It is people like Bill Gates. It is people like Dan Schulman of PayPal. They see this looming tower, and that's why you're hearing them, as I am, talking about the danger ahead.
Well, on Windows, where's Microsoft? You know, I was doing my Walter Cronkite imitation today from Moscow to Maine. Okay, great. Microsoft. I got all the M's in there. Where is Microsoft if this is a core Windows issue?
They need to be prepared for more of this. And what is different, Tom, is the release of these tools from the National Security Agency. They are lethal devices. And I assure you, in Washington State today, those engineers are all hands on deck to try and be prepared for the next wave that's coming.
How fierce is the competition for talent here? You've unveiled a proposal here for a new service academy focused on cybersecurity. Just in terms of how many people are trained and able to do this kind of work, how fierce is the competition?
The short answer is not enough. The competition is beyond fierce. It's white hot. And we are going to have to ask our young men and women, as they do in the other branches of the military, to stand and deliver in a cyber force. Here's the good news. It doesn't have to be massive. We don't need hundreds of thousands of people, but we need 5,000 to 10,000 dedicated cyber warriors who can stand and respond to these kind of attacks, whether they come, in this case, from cyber criminals or from nation states or from terrorists.
What makes a good FBI director a wise one?
First of all, he or she has to be unbiased. Secondly, a law enforcement professional. I would argue someone who's been to law school, who's served at the highest levels of advising. And number three, the ability to speak truth to power. I think James Comey had those attributes, but he was burned by this president. Now we're going to have to ask another American to step into a very fraught situation.
That was retired Admiral James Stavridis, who is currently the Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University.
And coming up, we'll talk taxes with Representative Kevin Brady, Chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee.
You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
With the Bloomberg Business of Sports Report, I'm Michael Barr. The Cleveland Cavaliers will wear Goodyear's logo on their jersey starting next season. A person familiar with the contract told AP the agreement will give the Akron, Ohio-based tire manufacturer tremendous exposure because the Cavs are one of the NBA's most televised teams. It also helps that Cavs star LeBron James is from Akron. The sports betting app has picked up some prominent new backers. WinView says it has raised $12 million in a new round of financing. The backers include the former owner of the Washington Post, Graham Holdings, the owner of the Washington Wizards and the Washington Capitals, Ted Leonsis, and the boutique investment bank, Liontree. Omega has extended its contract as the official Olympics timekeeper. According to Thomas Bach, president of the International Olympic Committee, the contract has been extended to 2032. And that is a Bloomberg Business of Sports report. I'm Michael Barr.
It's 48 minutes past the hour, and now it's time for Bloomberg View.
I'm Justin Fox, a columnist for Bloomberg View. The U.S. economy isn't growing very fast. Some state economies are. New state GDP data has Texas, Utah, Florida, and Washington leading the way, with annualized real growth of more than 3% in last year's final quarter. To get a longer view of state economic health, I looked at the states with the fastest growing GDP over the past year, the course of the current economic recovery, and since the year 2000. The only two to rank in the top 10 for every period were California and Utah. Texas came close. That's two red states and a blue one. It's one of the country's highest tax states, California, one of the lowest tax states, Texas, and one in the middle, Utah. All are west of the Mississippi. All are economic powerhouses. Got a simple explanation for that? I'm Justin Fox, a columnist for Bloomberg View. For more Bloomberg opinion and commentary, please go to BloombergView.com or ViewGo on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Thank you, Justin. And now let's check in with the Bloomberg affiliates to find out what's happening on the nation's most influential radio stations.
I'm Elisa Parenti. On KNX in Los Angeles, I'm reporting on Venice-based Snapchat rolling out a new slate of promotional lenses or filters that superimpose corporate logos.
I'm Steve Potisk, and on KYW in Philadelphia, I'm talking about a labor shortage in Pennsylvania's mushroom industry.
I'm Courtney Donahoe on WoWo in Fort Wayne. General Motors jumps ahead of Ford in improving its supplier relations.
I'm Larry Kofsky, and on Bloomberg 99.1 in Washington, I'm reporting on the addition of another event venue at Gaylord National Resort.
Thanks, Larry. Ever since President Trump took office, we've been hearing about tax reform. And this week, we'll start to see some action when the House Ways and Means Committee begins to hold hearings. The chairman of that powerful committee, Congressman Kevin Brady, talked with Bloomberg's David Westin.
So take us into this hearing you're going to start on Thursday. Just start with that. What sorts of witnesses are you going to be calling? What are you looking to hear in those hearings?
Yeah, so when we started out on tax reform, we set two goals for this effort. One, we want a tax code built for growth, literally designed to grow jobs, wages, and the U.S. economy. And we want to leapfrog America from 31st in the world in tax competitiveness into that top three and keep us there. So this hearing is all about growth. We'll be listening to business leaders talk about the competitive environment they're in, what it takes to actually grow those jobs and wages. And we're just going to open it up. And this is part of, I think, a coordinated effort between the House and the White House and Senate, where we begin to open up our ideas on how to grow this economy in a big way and make sure, you know, the American public can listen in and be part of this conversation.
And you're going to be having hearings, so I know that you're going to be thinking about what you're hearing and you'll be changing things. But there are a couple of plans out there already. You're not working with a blank sheet of paper. On the one hand, you and the Speaker, Ryan, have got a plan that's been on the website for some time. We have the outline from the White House. Where do those sync up? Where are you at one with the White House right now in terms of what things you want to do?
Yeah, I always think I describe this as being about the two plans, about 80% in sync in major ways. We've still got some work to do going forward as well. But going bold on the rates, critically important because of what our competitors do worldwide. Making sure that our tax code's redesigned so we can compete with those new tax models that are on the road today is critical. Making sure businesses can invest with confidence that really drives Main Street job growth and productivity as well. And then on the family side, of course, you know, simplifying the code, lowering the rates, really making it easier for families, not just to file taxes, but to keep more of what they earn. Those we start with a very good foundation there.
So, Mr. Chairman, start with the rates, which you just mentioned. You and the White House agree you've got to cut them a lot from the 35%. But as I understand it, you're at 20%. They're at 15%. What will make you decide one over the other? Is it a question of how much deficit they incur?
Well, that's part of it. Look, we want the rates to get as low as we can. And by the way, that's the lowest rate for corporations in history and for every other type of business, the pass-throughs, as we call them, small businesses, partnerships as well. We lower those rates to the lowest since the 1930s as well, because that's incredibly pro-growth as well. So we're looking to try to get both of those rates down as low as possible. Actually, we think the greatest growth for the greatest number of years comes when tax reform is bold, when it's balanced within the budget, counting on economic growth, and it's permanent. So those factors will be part of the discussions that we're having with the White House. I think it's important for all of us to go into those discussions with our best solutions and be open to finding a way forward.
But specifically, you've always wanted to be bold and you wanted to cut the rates. Why didn't you go to 15% in your plan? Was it a concern about deficit? What will determine which you go with?
Well, that was part of the discussion as well. And again, you know, ours balances within that 10-year window and with the 20-year window as well because of this. We think history shows the most growth for the greatest number of years comes when tax reform is permanent, when businesses can count on this rate in the designs and they can make those investments long-term with certainty. And so that's what we took into our discussions. And we're going to have those discussions with the White House and our Senate colleagues as well.
So you want to make them permanent so people can predict. They make investments based on predictable rules. That does require revenue neutrality.
Absolutely.
You also have a border adjustment tax in your provision. You've come out very strongly in support of that. Do you need that in order to make them permanent?
You know, we do in my view, but more importantly, you need that because the current tax code actually drives jobs overseas and favors foreign workers and products over American workers and product. So we're proposing equal taxation for the first time of all products and services in the U.S. So it doesn't matter where it's produced, it doesn't matter who produces them, they're taxed equally. That is a big change from where we're at. We don't expect industry to pivot on a dime with a change that big. And so we've been listening to our local businesses and job creators. We're going to bring new solutions to the table with the White House. But yes, because our competitors beat us today with low rates, with no longer taxing world, and they border just as well, we think it's important to go straight at our competitors like China, Europe, Canada, and Mexico.
So, Mr. Chairman, talk about that competitiveness on two fronts. The repatriation of the money that's held offshore. What do you got to do to fix that? And the other is inversions, which is actually a somewhat different issue about the incentive to actually move your headquarters offshore. How do you fix that problem?
Yeah, so on the first, what we're proposing going forward permanently, but that the tax rate to bring your earnings back to reinvest in the United States be zero going forward. And we propose sort of a bifurcated rate, 3% plus and 8% plus for the stranded profits that are already overseas to bring those back as well. And then on the inversion issue, really, you need to do three things very strongly. One, we've got to lower the rates, again, to be competitive. Secondly, no longer taxing worldwide. That allows our businesses to deploy their capital where it makes them most successful. And then border adjustability, because that eliminates, not only eliminates every tax incentive to move your jobs or research or headquarters overseas, it actually creates very strong permanent incentives to bring those jobs, those research, those patents, and headquarters back to the United States. That's why we continue to make a case for border adjustability, because it's so key to ending that march of jobs and headquarters that are leaving America today.
In order to pencil this out, to make the numbers work, are you going to have to eliminate the business interest deduction?
In my view, yes, but there's a growth issue here that's really driving it, not so much the dollars here. Because look, today, as you know, there's dozens of ways to finance your acquisitions, your operations, your other activities. The tax code favors one, borrowing. So we're proposing to take the tax preference for the source of funds and apply it to the use of funds, which is full and unlimited expensing. And here's why. We know that when businesses invest in buildings, equipment, software, and technology, it drives productivity, it drives Main Street job growth in a major way. I think that trade-off may be the most pro-growth provisions in this tax code. We know, too, look, this is a big change from where we're at. So we are looking at the issues our businesses have asked us to consider, including grandfathering existing debt, a glide path going forward, so there's certainty for businesses that borrow a lot as well.
If you're going to give me your best guess about timing, when could there be a bill through the House, and when could it be on the president's desk for signature?
Yeah, that is a great question. So I think the important factor here is that the White House, the Senate, and the House have agreed to work together on one single unified tax reform plan. I think that accelerates actually this activity. I think our goals shouldn't be focused so much on the month, but the year, which is this year, 2017, I think is critical. A lot more work has to be done. Tax reform, as you know, is the challenge of a generation for any Congress. We do have a lot of work to do, but I'm confident we can finish it this year.
That was Kevin Brady, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, speaking with Bloomberg's David Westin.
And that's all for this edition of Bloomberg Best.
If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go.
Our show is produced by David Sucherman, Richard Truman, and Reginald Bazile. I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm June Grosso. This is Bloomberg.